You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast. Hey, everybody, this is Chuck Marone with Strong Towns. Welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. I was listening a while back to a clip that someone had sent me. It tweeted it out to me, and I've gone back and tried to find it, and I can't find it. It was a briefing that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was doing around coronavirus, and it was sometime this past summer. I didn't talk about it then because it was one of those things that I think would be interpreted as political, and I just wanted to get beyond the election before I brought it up. It was a briefing. You know, a lot of governors have been doing this. In Minnesota, our governor has been doing this. But Governor Cuomo got up and he was talking about the transit system being in decline, having huge budget shortfalls in New York City's transit system. He was talking about other budgetary problems around businesses and infrastructure and what have you. And in an offhanded way, he said that we should just print the money. He was calling on the federal government to support New York, to give New York aid, to provide money for the state. And he, in a very offhanded way, just said, like, hey, what is the problem? Like, why are you being stingy? Just print the money. Why would you let us suffer? Why would you not do this? It's within your power to do it. Just print the money. It struck me, and I know you've heard this from me before. I'm going to give you a little bit different spin on it today. I feel like we have entered, or maybe, you know, we've been here for a while and I'm just waking up to it, but we are clearly in the cultural part of this just print the money phase, right? Just print the money. I want to tell you about the company that I ran starting in 2000 called Community Growth Institute. I left the engineering firm I was at and went to grad school in the fall of 2000. I was in my mid-20s at that point, and I was actually just going to go to grad school for a couple of years, and my plan was to come back and go back to work for the engineering firm here in my hometown. That's what I wanted to do. When I left, they were, I'll say this nicely, because they were very kind to me, but there were a few people there, and they just happened to be the people in charge who were rather upset with me, or who were, let me just say, hurt by the fact that I left. It felt like a little bit of a rejection to them, even though that wasn't my intent, and I actually wanted to go back. But, you know, I think that the question was, why would you leave, Chuck? But I did, and an amazing thing happened. When I left, a handful of cities that I had either been directly working with or working kind of adjacent to that needed planning help got a hold of me and asked if I would help them. It was one city first, city that I actually was living in at the time, and I was on the planning commission. Their city clerk, who was also their city planner, was leaving. They asked if I would fill in. I did that for a month. A month turned into 3 months. 3 months went really well. And I said, well, I could do this, you know, longer than that. I signed a one-year contract with them in January. I started school in September, signed a one-year contract in January. At that point, a couple other cities had also called. I started doing work for them. I went back to the engineering firm and said, hey, these places want me to do this work. I'm happy to do this through you. So like you can get this contract and I will work for you. They weren't interested in that. And so I wound up on my own. I wound up, you know, starting an LLC, not knowing, you know, really what I was doing beyond I could do the planning work. Didn't know anything about running a business. Wound up kind of diving into that. And in the way that all entrepreneurs do, in the way that all startups do, learned by making a lot of mistakes, figured stuff out. And by the time I graduated from graduate school, by the time I left there, I was there 2 years, and took me a little bit longer to meet the requirements to graduate because of my final paper and what have you. But by the time I left, by the time I was ready to move back up to my hometown, my wife and I, you know, moved back here. I had started my own company. I had hired, you know, at that point I had 3 or 4 of my fellow classmates that I had hired. I was working with dozens of cities across the state of Minnesota. And I had a real business. I mean, I had a business that was providing a service that people wanted. And, you know, we were getting paid to do it. It was a really great thing. I remember going for a walk with my wife in 2004. She was pregnant at the time. And I remember us just talking about our future. And I said, I would like to do this thing, you know, which at the time, this Community Growth Institute, I would like to give this a try for a decade. I think I can do a lot of good. I think I can get paid to do it, so I can support our family doing it. And, you know, those two things combined together make it better for me, or you know, something I wanted to do more than, at the time there was a very steady job with the local city government that I'm pretty confident I could have gotten if I had applied. It was going to pay a lot, especially in comparison to what I was making. It would have been a lot fewer hours. There were a lot of things about it that were enticing enough for us to take a long walk and discuss it. But I remember saying, like, I would like to try this for a decade and see where it takes me. And she, because she's a beautiful woman and because she's, you know, my wife, she said, yes. She said, let's do that. Let's give it a try. As part of running this company, we grew very quickly. Those of you that are not familiar with the consulting business, consulting in one hand is very complex and another is very simple. You do work. People pay you for that work. They generally pay you by the hour. So the more hours you work, the more money you make. And when you hire other people, if they do not work at things that you can bill, you know, people for, that you go out of business pretty quick. And so when you hire people, there's kind of this window where you have to get them trained in, get them up to speed, get them working in a community, get them billable, which would be the way we would discuss it internally, and billable at enough of the hours where they actually pay for themselves. That is always a trick. And what I found is it takes a good 2.5-3 months before someone can turn cash flow positive. This is a very small company with very small margins. And I found right away that taking 2.5 to 3 months to get someone profitable was a really tough thing to do. I had a couple false starts. I had a couple people that I hired. In all earnestness, I thought would work out great. They thought they would be great. I had one person quit in 48 hours. That seems like a failure. That was actually a huge success because they figured out very early they couldn't hack it. I had another person who stayed 3 months, and at the end of 3 months, I could just see that they had kind of given up achieving the billable hours that they needed. This was a guy who came from a county government, really nice guy. I liked him, but he just was never going to cut it. We needed to have, in a 40-hour work week, we needed to have something like 28 to 30 hours of billable time for things to work out. I think he was at like 12 or 15 and just, you know, there was the gap was too big and I ultimately had to let him go. That was really, really hard. But there were other people who, you know, worked out and did well. And by the time they would, you know, get in and we would have them up to good billable hours and things were moving ahead. The problem is during those transition phase, someone had to still pay people's salary. So if you started and it took you 3 months to where your salary would actually be covered by the amount of time that you worked, that was 3 months where I had to pay you your salary and your benefits and your overhead and your expenses and all that I had to pay before you would even break even. And then it would take a number of months after that for me to, you know, recoup the money that I had spent in the first few months bringing you in. I mean, I would have $20,000, $25,000 invested in a person to get them to the 3-month mark. And, you know, when you have a couple of misses, that's a lot of money that you have that you're never going to recover, not from, you know, those specific people. Things were going really well, however. And what we found is that if we could borrow the money, which the bank was happy to loan us the money because we had kind of demonstrated that we had a business model that worked. If we could borrow the money, we could cash flow those first 3 months and then we could pay that money back. And so we established a line of credit. First it was $50,000, then it was $100,000. We had a $100,000 line of credit going into 2006. Because of the seasonal nature of what we were doing, sometimes we would, you know, tap into that a little bit more in January, February, when cash flow was very low, and then pay that down in July and August when our cash flow was really good, when people were really busy. So in 2006, we were sitting there in March or April, and the business was, I was kind of waiting for things to thaw out, people to start going in for permits again, people starting to get interested in playing. Basically, you know, in Minnesota here, things shut down for a few months because it's frozen out. And so we were waiting for things to kind of break loose in the spring. And it didn't happen. I was carrying at that point a little bit of cash flow debt from the winter, a little bit of debt from one of these false starts. I was looking forward to the spring to kind of, you know, start digging myself out of this and have a very successful year. 2005 had been our most successful year. So I was looking at 2006 as being even better. And then, you know, things didn't happen in the spring. And I kind of shrugged it off. I said, well, you know, it's been really cold. I had a whole bunch of excuses. We had a late winter snowstorm. People are slow getting started. Things will pick up in April. In April, things didn't pick up. I had a whole bunch of excuses then too. We've had a rainy April or, you know, whatever it was. I had a whole bunch of reasons why. Things will pick up in May. Things didn't pick up in May. And they didn't pick up in June. And by the time we got to mid-June, I was sitting there with a mound of debt, a lot of bills that I couldn't pay. In addition to the debt, you know, just my phone bill, my internet bill, my lease payments, all this stuff. And I had, you know, a staff of 13 and I had very little cash coming in comparison. You know, I had cash flow needs and I just couldn't make payroll. I remember having to go to my dad, and this was a very difficult thing to do, and borrow money from him to make a payday. I had to go to my wife and explain why not only had I not taken a couple of years earlier this very secure job that would have made me work less and been home more and been more attentive to her and the family and all that, but I was actually in a position now where I had large amounts of debt and couldn't make payroll, and we were not going to get paid. We were going to have to really cut back and tighten the belt. What I was experiencing was the beginning of the housing crisis, right? We had systematically overbuilt housing. We had overinflated the housing market. We had created an artificial situation in this country that, as it trickled down to me at the local level, had given me all the signals that, you know, there was huge demand for my services. And so I had beefed up my company, beefed up my staff, done all this stuff, taken huge amounts of risk in response to these signals that there was a huge amount of demand and all of a sudden there was not. By the time you get to 2008 and you have banks failing and people being foreclosed on and what would become the housing crisis, I had had to work through, a year and a half of just brutal financial beating. Because, you know, before you can default on a home, you have to build the home. Before you build the home, you have to create the subdivision. You have to do a plat. You've got to, you know, lay out the whole thing. Before you do that, you have to come and see me in 75 different cities across Minnesota. And so, you know, our stuff dried up 2 years ahead of everybody else's. By the time we got to 2008, we were a mess. Let me put it this way. By the time we got to 2008, I had failed. But, you know, my company was a failure. I had, you know, over $150,000 in debt and payables and bills, money I owed the government in taxes, money I owed people in salaries, money I owed utility companies, and then just, you know, big notes that I owed the bank. I was down to just two employees. I'd gone from 13 to two. I'd gone from five offices to two offices. We had just a handful of clients left. It was a disaster. It was an absolute disaster. Here's the interesting thing. If someone had come to me in 2006 and said, here, Chuck, here's a bunch of money. You could not have seen this housing crisis coming. It wasn't of your making. You know, had no responsibility for the fact that, you know, people were taking on all these risks and going to burst this market. That was not you. Here's money for you to get through. We're going to loan you, in a sense, an infinite amount of money. However much money you need, we will loan you so you can get through this crisis and get back to a position of solvency. What would that have done? What would have happened? The interesting thing about 2008 is I was actually making money in 2008. I had these huge debt payments that it was all going towards. And, you know, I was paying down all this money that I owed. It's 2020 today. I still have like $6,000 I owe off of this. I mean, it's still being like slowly whittled down. I made a long-term note in about 2012 or something like that, that's being paid off still little by little. I could have paid, basically by 2008, it was a disaster. If someone had come to me in 2006 and given me money, what would I have done? I would not have been in a position in 2008 to be making money, I can tell you that. I would not have been forced to reconsider my business plan. What I wound up doing in 2008 that got us profitable is not only closing a bunch of offices that weren't making money, not only laying off people that were, you know, marginally productive and going down to just the core group of people that was, I started charging cities more. I said, you know, we're underpricing our work. And these places that are not willing to pay, I'm not going to work with. And the places that are willing to pay for this service, because it was a high quality service, we will work with you. And I started making money. You know, it started to work. If you had come to me in 2006 and said, hey, Chuck, we know you have $150,000 in debt and liabilities here. We will loan you another $150,000. Like, don't worry about it. And if you got to use the debt to make your debt payments, okay, we will loan you this money and we will continue to loan you money until the crisis is abated, right? Until we get through this. Would I have done that? Absolutely, I would have done that. I would have had every incentive to do that. I had a wife and a child. I had another child on the way. I had a mortgage. I had a good reason why I could have convinced myself that A, through no fault of my own, I find myself here. B, it's only a matter of time before it works itself out. And C, I deserve this. I worked hard. I sacrificed. I deserve this. If you would have just printed the money and given it to me, I would have, in 2008, had a crappy company, a company with a bad business model, a failing company, really, quite frankly, that hadn't been forced to make difficult decisions, but one where everyone was employed and everyone was getting paid and the money was still flowing through. Just print the money. I look at Andrew Cuomo, and part of what he was talking about was the MTA. I wrote an article last month about the Metropolitan Transit Authority in New York. There were news reports that the MTA is facing doomsday, is the word they use, doomsday cuts, unless they get federal aid. The MTA has obviously experienced a large decrease in ridership during the pandemic. You could say this is not something anyone could have seen coming. I mean, okay, I mean, I will accept that. I will accept that, you know, in the projections and scenarios, a 80% cut in ridership is not something you can really anticipate. even if that is, you know, 50% or 40% or 30% long term. Yeah, maybe you can't anticipate that. Okay, I'm willing to accept that. The MTA right now is asking for $12 billion immediately as a bailout just to get them through the rest of the year. They have $35 billion in debt already. 80% of the fare revenue they collect goes to paying debt. I think this is whacked. I mean, and it's not just that, you know, I don't think fare revenue should go to debt, period. I think that capital improvement should be financed in other ways. I don't think operating expenses should be taken out of debt. But, you know, regardless, they've got some plans to reduce that percentage. But right now, a huge percentage of their revenue goes to just servicing their past debt. There's a quote here, and let me find it. This is from the Transit Authority's chairman, a guy named Patrick Foy. He said, and I found this remarkable, which is why I wrote it down. The future of the MTA and the future of the New York region lies squarely in the hands of the federal government. I just find that stunning. Our country's richest city and what is arguably our country's richest state, the future and the prosperity of this place, which is, you know, like if you're sitting around going, okay, we're poor, we're not doing too well, things aren't going great. You know, if we could just have the wealth that New York has, if we could just have the prosperity that a place like New York has. No, their future lies squarely in the hands of the federal government. In other words, if we don't get a bailout, if we don't get the federal government to come in here and give us a bunch of money, it's over. Like our prosperity is shot. How is this possible, right? In the richest city in North America. Just print the money, right? Just give them the money. I look at the MTA and what I see is a bad system, a system that badly needs reform. I'm not a starve the beast kind of person. I'm not one who's sitting arguing that, you know, let them fail, cut their budget. I mean, I actually wrote a piece about this where I said, here's what I would do. You know, I would give them their bailout. I would actually get rid of their debt, but here's what I would require in exchange for that. Some serious reform. I look at the way that they finance things, and there are no good feedback loops between the things that they choose to do and the things that their customers want. There's also no good feedback loop between what people are willing to pay for and what the value that they're creating is and what the costs that they're incurring are. You should not have a transit system in a place where you have the most expensive real estate in North America, perhaps the most expensive real estate in the world. You should not have a transit system serving that area, that literally building that wealth and value that is not the most opulent transit system in the world. New York MTA is far from opulent and in fact is having a difficult time even staying in existence. Any reform that needs to happen, any changes that need to come about will never come about in a cultural ethic where we say, just print the money. It will never happen. And so even if you are not a starve the beast person, which I'm not, even if, you know, starve the beast is this idea that, you know, if you look at a business like mine, Community Growth Institute, and you starve it of resources, what happens? We have to innovate. We have to change. We have to innovate. We have to become a different company. That's what we did. I don't think that that necessarily transfers to government. Governments don't respond in that way. That doesn't mean they don't need reform. That doesn't mean they don't need change. And if we just go and say, okay, just print the money, just give it to them, what does that do? What does that help? What becomes better? We live in this world of abstractions. And I've come to spend a lot of time thinking about this, this world of abstractions, because part of it is, you know, the interface between the real world and the abstraction world is so obscured for us. Sometimes it's hard to parse them. You know, strong towns exist because we say it does, right? We all believe that strong towns exist. We all believe that there is a strong towns movement. And it exists because we believe it exists. If for some reason tomorrow we lost faith in this movement. If for some reason tomorrow we lost faith in the idea of building a strong town and how that is as a central organizing narrative for our movement, if we lost faith in that, what would happen? Well, strong towns as an abstraction, as an idea, would just cease to exist. It would go away. It's something that exists because we all believe it exists, not because you can actually like tangibly touch it or feel it or, you know, in a financial sense, transfer it to someone else. It is a abstraction created by the work we do here, the work you are doing, the fact that we're having this conversation, the fact that we believe similar things, the fact that people are willing to take action based on those beliefs. It's an abstraction. Let me give you another abstraction. My church is right across the street from me now is St. Francis Catholic Church. My church exists because people say they are Catholic. People show up there on Sunday. We cite, you know, certain creeds and beliefs every week that denote our Catholicism. If people stopped believing in the church, stopped believing in Catholicism, if people stopped going to church, what would happen? The Catholic faith would go away. It's an abstraction. It's not a real thing in a tangible sense. You know, Christianity could go away the way that other religions of the past have gone away because there are no more adherents. Yet, let's say that every Catholic in Brainerd just faded away, stopped going, did not, you know, care about their faith anymore. We're not part of the church. The abstract part of it would go away. The Catholicism would go away. The Christianity would go away. But the building would still be there, right? The building is actually not an abstraction. It is a physical thing. It is a actual real thing that we could sell, that we could trade, that we could split apart, and we could take the organ and melt it down for its constituent metals, and we could take the altarpiece and sell it to someone to do something with. You know, there are, you know, all kinds of different tangible things, things that are not abstractions that can be done with that building. I'm going to go somewhere where I haven't gone before on this podcast. I've danced around this and we've talked about it in brief, but I'm going to dig into it a little bit. People always get mad when I talk finance and economics, and not people. That's an abstraction. There's a certain subset of our audience. I will categorize you as people who have a certain political belief that is tied to a certain set of, you know, religious beliefs about economics that you are wedded to. And I have tried my best to understand you. I can't make that leap. I'm going to talk just a minute about money. Money, you can take out of your wallet, right? A dollar bill. It has value because we say it does. We all believe it. It is the ultimate abstraction. You look at your bank account and there's some line items that digits, you know, code that print out what your balance is in your bank account. You look at your retirement account. You look at your loan account. If you go to the bank, there's not like a physical paper of IOU there. If you go to your retirement account, there's not like a vault with gold sitting inside of it for most people anyway. There's nothing like tangible there. It is an abstraction. It's a digital abstraction. It's a digital abstraction of a financial abstraction, money. And we believe it has value because we believe it has value. If we stop believing tomorrow that dollars had value, they would just be paper, right? I have sitting here in my office a $10 trillion Zimbabwe note. I think I bought it for like $3 as a novelty. In terms of Zimbabwe, it is worthless as currency. I bought it because it is actually kind of a novelty, but in terms of its value, it is essentially worthless. It's a it's a piece of paper. It has as much value as, you know, the piece of paper that I read with this quote on it and all the uses that that piece of paper would have. The note has to people in Zimbabwe. It's nothing. Now, trigger warning for those of you that the gold conversation makes you mad and frustrated and makes me sound like, you know, oh, there's gold in them, their heels, you know, like some old timey Luddite. I'm just going to point out that our currency used to be backed by gold. There was something tangible. So you had a dollar. Actually, you had to have $33. And if you had $33, you could take those $33 and you could go to the mint and you could say, all right, I want my gold. This is actually a certificate for gold. And they would give you that. And so there was, in a sense, something tangible about dollars. The dollar itself was an abstraction. If it burned, if you gave it away, you would not get something of value. It itself did not have value, but it represented something that did. It represented gold. That's gone. We don't do that anymore. And so the dollar is purely an abstraction. I mean, our currency is purely an abstraction. It's one that we all believe in, and we all believe it has values. And there's reasons why we believe it has value. We believe it has value because I can go today and I can buy something and I can give people, I can transfer from my digital account to your digital account a certain number of these accounting units, and you will then send me something that is tangible. I'm drinking a Diet Mountain Dew. I acquired this Diet Mountain Dew by giving the store, by sticking my credit card in and transferring some digital bytes on my credit card to the grocery store and their ledger. They acquired that Mountain Dew by transferring money from their ledger to the Pepsi Cola company, who in turn, you know, acquired their Mountain Dew by created this can of beautiful goodness by, you know, paying workers and buying supplies and putting it all together. These abstractions are what like lubricate the economy, right? Like I get that aspect of it. But underneath, what works is that we all believe in it. I'm not going to get into modern monetary theory. I'm not going to go there, except just to point out that underlying modern monetary theory, it's the intellectual justification for just print the money. Underlying that theory is the idea that the government, because we require taxes to be paid in dollars, create, in a sense, the market for dollars, or create the realness of our currency. If the government allows you to pay your taxes in, you know, whatever form, you can pay it in labor, you can pay it in gold, you can pay it in barrels of oil, seashells, whatever the government, if they accepted multiple forms of payment, what would happen is that some people would have confidence in and some people would not. Because the government requires that you pay your taxes in dollars, it forces you to accumulate a certain number of dollars. In a way, it forces you beyond that abstraction to actually think of the dollar as having value, because it does have value for you to pay your taxes, which you're required to do. I get where this line of thinking comes from. It seems very heavy-handed to me, like very authoritarian. Yet, you know, I get it. I understand. And I understand why people who want to believe this like it. You know, it sets the government up as like the determinant of what is real and what is not real. When you dig deep into that, what you find is that the government itself is actually an abstraction. There is a place called the White House. It's a physical building. There is a place called Congress. It's a physical building. But the whole thing that binds it all together, the idea that there's an executive branch, that there's a legislative branch, that there's a judicial branch, the idea that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is the ultimate abstraction, right? It's something we believe. It's something we collectively believe is true. It's not something that is intrinsically true, although, you know, we're saying that it is. You're endowed by your creator. The idea there is to create a truth beyond the abstraction. I can buy that. I don't know, as a society, we will buy that. So you have abstraction layered on top of abstraction, layered on top of abstraction. Just print the money, right? I feel like the idea of just print the money is kind of almost a taunt to this belief system. You're almost taunting the abstraction. This stuff isn't real. It doesn't really exist. It's not pretending to be anything tangible. So just print the money. Like, we have a problem. We have a struggle. We can solve it with more. Just print the money. And you're almost, by saying that, laughing in the face of this abstraction, right? One of the reasons why we believe the things that we believe, whether it is, Catholicism, the Strong Towns movement, whether it's, that the dollar has value. One of the reasons why we believe these things is because, quite frankly, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about them. We just believe them. We just believe that they're true. I think if we spend a lot of time thinking about, is money real? In Christian faith, the idea of is God real may seem to non-Christians like a very valid line of inquiry. But understand that for most Christians, it's not something they spend a lot of time thinking about. That is the kind of nature of faith. If you have a crisis of faith, you will sit and ponder whether God is real. If you have a crisis of currency, you will sit and ponder whether, the currency is real, whether the government is real, whether any of this is anything more than a mere abstraction. I was listening to some people talk about the stock market. And to me, the stock market has become, in the most dangerous of senses, this chief abstraction. The reason why, I've spent so much time talking about these abstractions upon abstractions upon abstractions is I do think that there's a layering here, a kind of house of cards, in a sense, that is really, really dangerous. We used to have this idea that a stock represented something tangible, right? Take a motor company, take like General Motors. General Motors has plants where they build cars, they have equipment, they have workers that they've trained, they have supply lines, they have things that are very physical in nature, things that are very tangible, that if General Motors went bankrupt, we could split apart and sell off as parts. Sometimes this is called book value in investment terms. When you look at all the assets that they actually have, what is there? A lot of businesses will book something. I've seen it called blue sky. I've seen it called a number of different things. It's basically like, what is the value of all this abstraction worth? Major companies have gone out of business. Kodak is a good one, who is, not necessarily declared bankruptcy. I don't think they did, but are basically able to trade off their name today because their name has cachet. Donald Trump, and this is not a political statement, so trigger warning, don't get all politics on me. One of the things that Donald Trump did before he became president was he would buy things, put the Trump name on them, which, what is the Trump name? It's just an abstraction. Put the Trump name on them and then sell them for an inflated value. Literally, he did this a number of times, and the only real, thing that changed was just the name associated with the property. That is taking an intangible, right, an abstraction, and adding it on to something that is tangible. Stocks, in an old school way of investing, in the way of investing that I feel comfortable with, let me put it that way, you would value a company based on what its assets are, what its cash flow is, and with some, is maybe some allowance for blue sky, some allowance for the credibility and good name, the abstraction. It feels like today, the value of a stock is basically a function of two things: the amount of liquidity in the market and the narrative that's applied to that stock. By liquidity, just for you non-financial people, the amount of money that's flowing around through the system. Think back to my company in 2006. I couldn't get money to continue to do the way we were. I had to make these difficult cuts. if there had been more money made available to me, I was given a loan, I was given access to credit, what have you, that would be considered liquidity. As long as we can keep money flowing through the system, and as long as we have a story that explains what has happened, stock prices seem to do great. We just broke an all-time market high yesterday as I'm recording this podcast. We'll probably break another high today. In 2008, what we had in the housing market was an insolvency crisis. People did not have the income to pay for the houses that they had purchased. People did not have the assets in a real world sense to pay for the real world homes that they owed money on. They didn't have it. They didn't have the money to maintain them. They didn't have the money to furnish them. They did not have the money. This was an insolvency crisis. The insolvency crisis at the individual level was made worse by the fact that businesses, banks, hedge funds made bets on our ability as real humans to repay these loans. You could say that those bets were abstractions, and I'm fine with that. Although they were abstractions of very real, tangible things. They are more abstractions like, you know, the Catholic faith is an abstraction from the Catholic Church. You take away the faith, the church is still there. A mortgage-backed security and a, you know, collateralized debt obligation based on that is an abstraction, but you take those away and there's still a house there. There's still something there. That something there was insolvent. It did not have enough wealth or asset or value to justify the level of debt on it. And so what we had in 2008 was an insolvency crisis. How do we work this out? Well, how did we work it out? We just printed money, right? We just created liquidity along with a narrative. The narrative was we need to bail out the banks. The banks are, you know, and not the one or two banks that were bad. We're going to give everybody money so nobody knows who's bad. The narrative is we need to get the economy back to work. Go ahead and have trust in your bank. Put the money in there. They might be insolvent, but we're not going to let them fail. We're not going to let these insurance companies fail. We're going to keep them solvent too. We're going to give them money. We're going to give them bailouts. You won't know which ones are bad and which ones are not because we're just going to pump a bunch of money in there. Go ahead and stay in your home. We want to keep you in your home. It's not that you're insolvent. We don't care. We're going to keep grow. We're going to grow our way out of this. We created a story that we told ourselves that justified all kinds of like insane stuff as, in a sense, a temporary measure to allow us to get out of this crisis. And what you saw is that years later, I mean, 2015, 2016, we were still in what you would call emergency measures. We still had historically low interest rates. We were still unable to raise them in any way without setting off a cascade of decline. We were still in, you know, this situation where it took massive amounts of liquidity and an overwhelming narrative to keep things going because the underlying system was functionally insolvent. Does this work? I think it's an open question right now. I don't feel like it works. I feel like it's a fraud. I feel like it is, you know, like I said, a house of cards. I don't feel like this works. Yet there are really, really, really intelligent people, really brilliant people who are gambling huge amounts of money that this does work, that this is a viable solution. 2020, we have another insolvency crisis. In March, stocks started to crater. They went way down. We saw businesses that, you know, were struggling during good times, now, you know, laid bare. Boeing is a good example of a business that, for all intents and purposes, was a failed company, had a number of high-profile failures, was doing some really crazy financial stuff to stay afloat, and then all of a sudden, we gutted, you know, the airline industry, the demand for its products. GE is another one, just like this mountain of debt and kind of like financial alchemy. I saw once that it was an astounding percentage, I want to say like 20%, it might be more than that, before the pandemic, of S&P 500 listed companies these are good companies. I mean, these are companies that are on the S&P because they're decent companies, were illiquid and insolvent to the point where their cash flow didn't even make their debt payments. So to stay around, they were forced to take on more debt to pay the interest on their old debt, not the principal, just the interest. What was our solution, or what was our way of dealing with this insolvency crisis? Just print the money, Chuck. Just print money. And I can hear you. I can hear you out there in the audience are saying, well, Chuck, you know, we're in a pandemic. What were we supposed to do? And my answer is, when are we not in a crisis? Point to me the day when we are no longer in a crisis. No longer in a crisis that justifies printing the money, right? When does that day pass? I run a nonprofit organization. We have revenues, we have expenses, we have payroll, we have commitments. When is it not a crisis here? It's always a crisis. Now, are we going out of business? No. Is this a crisis in the sense that, like, we're, you know, 2 weeks away from insolvency? No, we don't have a lot of assets. We don't have any liabilities. We have cash flow. We're doing all right. You know, we just got done with a member drive. Our members are very helpful. They've been very supportive. They're very generous. We have a good, stable, solid base. But I'm telling you, if we had more money, we could do way more. The crisis comes from us, of the demand, us not being able to meet all the demand that's out there with the resources we have. Well, what if we could just get more? What if we could just get more? When are we not in a crisis? When will we reach a state of being where we say everything is good, we're no longer in crisis? The answer is never, never, right? Tesla is a special case, and it's an extreme example. I was proud of the S&P when they did not add Tesla, a hedge fund, basically, to its S&P 500 list. This last week, Elon Musk became the second richest man in the world, largely because Tesla stock has grown to enormous proportions. When we talk about liquidity plus a narrative, to me, the headline company of this, the Pets.com of the current era, Pets.com being the liquidity plus a narrative story of the dot-com era. Pets.com was ruthlessly destroyed when the market required something more than a narrative, required actual earnings, actually something tangible. Tesla is, you know, to me, the current version of Pets.com. And because it's the current version, it is 1,000 times bigger and 1,000 times bigger problem, because that's what we've done in the current time. Tesla as a company is worth more than, you know, all the other US automakers combined, even though they produce a fraction of the vehicles. Tesla has, and by a fraction of the vehicles, I mean like 1%, 2% of the vehicles. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny fraction. Tesla has faced bankruptcy many, many times over the last decade. And they've been saved by two things, right? By liquidity and a narrative. I talked to someone once who was a huge supporter of Tesla, an investor. He had a lot of money invested in Tesla. I asked him, I said, do these valuations make you uncomfortable? You know, the stock has gone up, you know, I don't know how many X times at that point. It's astounding. They're not making that many vehicles. Their profit margins don't exist. They actually lose money on every car they make. I'm like, you know, do you worry about this? This seems insane to me. And his response was, well, they have great battery technology and the market's undervaluing the battery technology. And I'm like, well, how much is the battery technology worth? And the answer was, well, more than what, you know, the market's valuing it at. And I just look, I'm like, that is a narrative. That's a story you're telling yourself. That's BS. There's nothing real about that. And that's not to say there's nothing real about battery technology. It's not saying it can't be sold. That's not saying that, you know, Elon Musk and Tesla won't produce massive amounts of batteries at some point and they're going to be, you know, worth tons and they've had some breakthrough technology. Great. That's wonderful. But that is an abstraction. That is something that you don't know. That is something that you believe. And let me just point out, it's a belief that a couple of contrary facts could actually dispel really, really quickly. Here's my question about our insolvency. Can we make good on all these promises that we have based not on tangible things, not on doing things that are productive, on having things that actually build wealth and are, you know, have value? Can we make good on these promises that we've made simply by having liquidity and a narrative? Can we just print the money and have a narrative to go with it and have everyone believe that and be okay with it? Can we solve the pension crisis by just printing the money? Can we solve student loan debt by just printing the money? Can we fix our nation's transit systems and rail lines? Can we invest in high-speed rails and hyperloops and new technologies just by printing the money? Can we repair our infrastructure and build new infrastructure, build new frontage roads and interchanges and overpasses? Can we run sewer and water and broadband all over and not worry about whether it pays off or whether it pays back or whether there's a return on the investment? Can we just do it with printing the money and then adding a narrative? Can we fix the MTA by just printing money? Can we address the insolvency of this whole suburban experiment with a lot of liquidity and a good narrative? I think the answer to this is yes, on the liquidity side. We can just print the money. There is no question that we can continue to transfer digital funds to as many places as we want, and we can use that to deal with like the immediate insolvency problem. The question that I have then is, what is the narrative? What's the narrative that goes with it? You can already see on the student loan, the narrative breaking down. For people who have huge amounts of student loan debt, the narrative is very easy. I took on this debt. I want to be a productive member of society. I can't be a productive member of society if I have all this debt. I need help. I get that. It's very straightforward. For people who don't have government debt, there's a different narrative, though, and I think this is why the first narrative breaks down. Why would we give a bunch of money to the professional class of this country? They're the ones who are doing the best. Why would we give a bunch of money to people who largely have greater net worths and greater assets and greater wealth, certainly greater employment opportunities than people who don't have college degrees? This seems like bailing out the rich, especially from the poor person's standpoint. What is the narrative that we use to justify bailing out this suburban experiment, this most insolvent of insolvent approaches that we're on? How do we justify paying to fix, you know, using this liquidity, these digital zeros? What do we do to say, we're going to go out and fix all these cul-de-sacs. We're going to fix all these frontage roads. We're going to fix all these bridges that never should have been built. All these unproductive interchanges, all these, you know, junky frontage roads that serve these falling down big box. We're going to go out and we're going to fix all that. We can print the money, just print the money. We can do it. What is the narrative that goes with it? I wrote down a few. Here's one. We're the USA. We are a great country. That would fly out in my part of the world. How's that fly in your part of the world? Does that work? We're a great country. Great country, have great infrastructure. USA, USA, USA. How about this? We're capitalists, and capitalists produce lots of capital. We need capital to keep the economy going. We need liquidity. Let's put it out there and let's let the creative people do their creative thing. Rah, rah, go infrastructure. You don't like that one? How about this narrative? We're a socialist country. We've always had this partnership between government and the marketplace. And the government makes key strategic investments, and then it unleashes people to go out and do productive things. That's a great public-private partnership. Some places call this socialism. We just call it good governance. Go America. Here's another one. Here in the United States, we are smarter. We're more innovative. We're more dynamic. We lead the world in new technology and new ideas and new approaches. Of course, we should spend this money. It will obviously pay off. Just print the money. There's another narrative that would say we're very hardworking. you know, Americans work harder. We are far more disciplined. If you give us the tools, we'll go get the job done. We're the go-getters. Just print the money. Print the money and we'll put the American people to work. Of course it'll pay off, right? My favorite one here is we deserve it. You know, I wrote down just like, we deserve it. You know, let's be kind, compassionate. Let's take care of our people. Things are tough. Things are hard. Come on, we deserve it. Let's just not think about it too hard. Just go do it. Just print the money. Here's the way I would like to conclude this. If you are going to believe that we've moved beyond tangibles and that this abstraction world is an okay world to live in, that it's fine if we're going to have a world of abstractions, a world of narrative, where we're going to tell ourselves stories and believe those stories and have those stories be the basis of the reality we actually live in, that we can just print the money and not have it be productive or have to be productive or have it mean anything or result in anything. We can just do it because it's a good unto itself, because this narrative will support it. Then I'm going to tell you one thing that you need. You need a common narrative. You need a story that everyone can believe in. You have to have that. That is the basis of narrative. That's a basis of belief. We just got done with an election. I don't think there's anyone out there who would argue with me that we aren't an amazingly divided country. Massive amounts of division. They fall along geographic lines. They fall along class lines. They fall along racial lines. They fall along all the historic lines of division. They have questioned the history of this country. These divisions have. There are two different versions of the history of America. There's two different views of the morality of this country. There's two different views of the place in this world that this country has. If we are going to do something, something fantastic and miraculous and something that's never been done in all of human history, at least not successfully, at least not at scale, which is to essentially move beyond whether something needs to pay off or not, whether something needs to be productive or not, whether something needs to be solvent or not, and just move beyond it into a narrative land, then you better make damn sure that you have a narrative that everyone can buy into. I don't think it works. And I don't think it will ever work. And I think part of the reason why the narrative side of it is breaking down is because the abstraction side is not real. The abstraction side itself is breaking down. I think this whole idea of just print the money is one of the most dangerous ones that we've ever come across. I think we can run this experiment. I think it can work for a while, but I think the consequences of it are just dire. I think that they are not able to be calculated and not able to be completely even thought through. But I think the biggest one is the destruction of belief itself. And when I look across this country, when I talk to people, when I listen to them, that's what I see. I see the corrosion, not of the money supply. I think that's going to come next. Not of institutions, although you can see that too starting to happen. I think the corrosion here is just in belief itself. And when we lose that, when we lose that capacity to believe in something, something bigger than ourselves, something that collectively binds us all together, how do we take collective action? How do we do anything together? I think we need a bottom-up revolution. I wrote a book about it, Strong Towns, a bottom-up revolution to rebuild American prosperity. As this year comes to an end, as we all look forward to transitioning out of 2020 and into the future, something hopefully better, I think what we have to focus on right now is, what do we believe? And we can all find something in our household, in our block, in our neighborhood, in our community that we can believe in. And I think we got to start there. I think we all have to start there and build up from that, as opposed to starting with a narrative and, in a sense, building down, explaining the block, explaining the neighborhood, explaining the city, explaining our household based on that narrative. Let's start with what's real. Go out there today and find something that's real. Plant your flag next to it. Give it a hug. Give it a kiss. Name it. Say that it's real. For me, right now, today, you know what's very real for me? The park in the middle of my town. I've been doing some volunteer work with some people around this park, and it's very real. It's very tangible. It's something that I can do. Find something you can do today. Go out and make a difference. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town. We'll talk again soon.
Taking risk is a necessity to becoming rich. It's also a necessity to go bankrupt.
Build, 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 build. That's the start. They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Just to echo what you said, there are no silver bullet solutions.
Chuck Marrone, this has been fascinating.
Who made this city?
The window is not always open, but if nobody's pushing, then once the window opens, there'll be no chance to go through.
I like you. I like your vision of the world.
The United Nations Earth Summit, Agenda 21. Yeah.